Hello, it's Tuesday, October the 26th. This is the Andrew Pearce Show, coming as ever from the Daily Mail Newsroom. Why vets are calling for British people to stop buying designer dogs with flat faces. Also, Extinction Rebellion. You know they drive me mad. They've finally been banned from all roads by the High Court. But will they pay any attention whatsoever? Why Facebook are deliberately, it seems, promoting harm, even at the expense of young people, because they make lots of money. And are COVID cases really dropping? Rising COVID cases have been putting both the NHS and government ministers under huge pressure in recent weeks. The leader of the opposition, Keir Starmer, has been calling for the government to move to Plan B, which would involve things like compulsory face masks. But could this be about to change, and quite dramatically? Because new figures suggest signs the recent virus surge may be slowing. 36,500 new COVID cases recording, the lowest in nearly a fortnight. Keith Neal is Emeritus Professor of Epidemiology and Infectious Diseases at the University of Nottingham, and he joins me now. Professor, we don't want to hail a false dawn, but there was a report on the front page of one of our national newspapers yesterday suggesting that in November the rate of infection would fall, and fall dramatically.
I think that's... The trouble is predicting anything is really getting harder and harder, because a small change in the numbers can make a big difference. If I give an example, if a vaccine is 97% effective or 90% effective, that means it's effective for the vast majority of people, but the model would be give three times difference for the number of people needing admission to hospital. I think we can be reasonably confident that with the rapid rollout of the booster for the people over 50 and those at high risk, we know that two doses was very good at keeping you out of hospital. Three doses will be even better. And we've taken that for people at extreme vulnerability, we'll be getting four. So I think we need to separate cases from disease. A lot of the cases are in people in the 10 to 19 age group who rarely get ill with COVID. They can get long COVID, and some can be quite ill. So there's good benefits to being vaccinated. But given the high rates of infection in this group, the virus is running out of people to infect, because they're not going to be going to reinfect these people that quickly, which is why it's not unreasonable to think that numbers may drop. But I do think it's important not to think we've beaten the virus, but get boosted.
Now, that's what I was going to ask you about the booster. There's been much criticism of the rollout of the booster jab, but it appears now whoever's in charge, the government, NHS, Public Health England, appear to have got a grip. And the figures at the weekend were much higher, and it seems that the booster jabs are being rolled out far quicker now.
Yeah, I think there's a number of difficulties. I think, one, I've been having trouble book my own booster on the Department of NHS's line, because I haven't gone past 1 week after 6 months. It does seem ludicrous that you can't book it for 6 months. They know who I am. They know when I have it. They said, no, you can't book. That just needs changing. I've actually managed to book it via my GP this morning, anyway, at the local centre. So I think, why can't people book it as soon as they can? Because also on my sort of local mail group of people with problems, people are crying out to get boosted. And I think some of the issues have been that there's been a slow uptake because people haven't been worried about it. But certainly people are now very keen to get done, which is, it's dependent on people wanting it.
What of the idea that the government, and we know ministers have appears to be pushing for this, I don't see why, if that's what they want, they don't just say we're going to do it, that the limit between the second jab and the booster should be cut from 6 months to 5 months, Professor. Would you go along with that?
I was in what I think group four or group five for my vaccine, and I'm due mine booster at first week of November. The people who, we're probably better off ensuring we use the vaccine, and importantly, the slots in the vaccine centres for the people most at risk, who are the people done. Now, Whether we do it at 5, 6, or 7 months probably doesn't make a lot of difference, but we do know that a six-month interval is very good at inducing long-term protection. It may be that if the clinics have spaces, then we might bring it down to 5 months, but I think it's important that the people who were done earliest are the ones most at risk get the opportunity to get the sessions first.
Now, also, if I could ask you ask you this also, part of Plan B, if the Labour Party got its way, would be compulsory vaccine passports, but also it would be the return of masks in public places, the return of social distancing. Even if COVID is beginning to fall back, Professor, is it just good common sense that if you go on a train, a bus, into a shop, a restaurant, you should be wearing a mask?
I think I'll take the restaurant out of that because you can't eat with your mask on.
Sure.
But everywhere else, we do know from good studies that if both parties are wearing a mask, it reduces transmission risk by 50%, i.e. halves it. That would have a big benefit. And I've always felt that Plan B should have been kept over a month ago, with the fact that what cost does it do to wear a mask in a shop? I do it all the time.
So
Everybody else in the shop does it. What's the problem? I think people are equating, it's my right not to wear a mask, but the right, Human Rights Act is quite clear. A right to life trumps everything else, and these people are at risk of killing people. They may not kill the person who is in the shop, but they could take it on to B, to C, to D, and E is vulnerable and dies. I think COVID passports, though, I think they're a separate issue. I personally think the being able to do your own lateral flow device test essentially makes them useless because they're open to fraud. You've only got to look at what happened at the Boardmasters Festival. Thousands of cases linked to only 46,000 people. Either they didn't do the lateral flow device tests, or they lied about the results, or they just couldn't do them properly. So I think we have to, a COVID passport has to be vaccine only to be valid. There was a bit today, some behavioural scientists suggesting, well, if you make COVID passports for big events, they'll go to little events. Within 0.3 of a second, my reply was, make it for little events as well. Bars and pubs complain they can't do it. I thought they had to check that you were 18 to buy alcohol. So what's the difference in checking the COVID passport, which will also have your age in it?
Very good point. You should be in charge of all of it, Professor.
I think I'm not claiming to be right, because not everybody's got all the right answers. But I think we just need to keep things simple, and we need to be able to say, well, what's the harm? We want to allow people to mix.
Of course we do.
So let's do things like wear masks.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that we can meet up with people we want to meet up. And working at home when you can, that's obviously, I think there is a good rationale for people to actually occasionally go to work and have a face-to-face and engage with people, particularly for new employees. But you don't have to do it every day for many people.
Absolutely. That's Keith Neal. He's Emeritus Professor of Epidemiology and Infectious Disease at the University of Nottingham. So visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe and get access to all our podcasts, our video pieces, and much more. If you want to get in touch, you tweet us at mailplus or me at ToryBoyPierce. Facebook is unquestionably making hate worse. That's according to evidence from a whistleblower, Frances Haugen, who appeared before the Online Safety Bill Committee of MPs yesterday. She said the social media giant is acutely aware its algorithms promote extreme content, yet are unable or unwilling to change. The committee is considering what new rules to impose on big social networks if they breach their duty of care to users. I'm joined now by Imran Ahmed, who's chief executive of the Centre for Countering Digital Hate. Imran, if I can use your first name, this is the first time we've sort of heard it almost from the horse's mouth, that they almost are willfully promoting extreme content because they make money on the back of it.
Yeah, and it's an extraordinary moment. If you remember back in the 70s, there was a famous incident with the Ford Pinto car, in which Mother Jones published an article in which Ford had calculated that their car, which was prone to exploding and killing everyone inside, they'd calculated it was cheaper to pay the lawsuits than it was to actually fix the car. In short, it was cheaper to let them burn. So, you know, Facebook has basically concluded the same thing. It's cheaper to let the world burn than to fix their service, because the truth is that they can't fix their service. Their service is by its very design, it's all about driving eyeballs and attention, and it has decided that it's willing to make anything the subject of that attention, even if it's hate, misinformation and extreme content.
I thought the really some of the interesting examples she gave was, the, for instance, the storming of the US Capitol by those Trump supporters in January, because she said a lot of the content is targeted at incredibly impressionable people. That event was witnessed in this country with complete horror that such a thing could be happening, and that people were being urged on to do it on social media.
Yes, and you know, it's one of those things where the people themselves, when they're in court, they say, "I just don't know what came over me." And the answer is, well, of course, it's that toxic milieu of misinformation, of hatred, of incitement, of lies, that people are trying to steal something from you. And of course, that drove them to the point of insanity, because that's what happened at the Capitol. It was an act of utter insanity, domestic terrorism. People storming, you know, the most sacred chambers of democracy. And I think that we see this not only with what happened at the Capitol, but we also see it with some of these absolutely bananas anti-vaxxers shouting and screaming outside of schools. We see it with, but we also see it, look, and this is the stuff that really gets to me personally. You see it with pro-anorexia content being dumped into young girls' time feeds. You think about the fact that their own studies that Frances Haugen has revealed concluded that Instagram was making our kids' mental health significantly worse. I think it comes down to companies who feel that they've been able to operate in a spirit of impunity because, to be frank, Andrew, I mean, and you know, I have to admit, I struggle with emojis myself. A lot of our legislators don't understand the technology, and so therefore have not been able to credibly regulate and have the subtlety required when you're dealing with a platform that is about speech. And I think you do have to be subtle. You have to be clever when you do that. And I don't think they necessarily come to the right conclusions. That said, the online safety bill, which is going through its as you will know, being a political veteran, that it's going through a draft bill process, which is quite unusual for a British bill. It's more like what happens in the US or in other countries. And so that takes the politics out of it, but it also allowed them to hear from a range of experts. I mean, I myself gave evidence a few weeks ago. Frances Haugen gave evidence to that committee yesterday. And I think it's really important that that's happening, because it's giving us a chance to get the best brains on this issue who understand the technology, the algorithm, the way it works. And I'd be really proud, Andrew, that this bill, which is only possible because we're now an independent Britain, which means that we're able to legislate and regulate tech on our own. Europe, the European Union has got its own initiative, the Digital Services Act, to deal with tech companies. But I actually think that Britain's attempt is more ambitious. It's potentially more effective than anything we're seeing around the world. So, you know, I'm wishing it Godspeed, really.
Indeed. And the thing, which I'm not a parent, but I've got many friends with children and I've got nephews and nieces. I found it absolutely shocking what she told us about Instagram, which is owned by Facebook. She effectively said it may never be safe for school children, as their own research says it turns them into addicts. Knowing that they're allowing bullying to follow children home to their bedrooms, the company did not want to act because it wanted to get them, quote, hooked for the future by the platform. That's shocking.
Well, I there was a documentary a short while ago, The Social Dilemma, which did enormously well on Netflix, directed by my friend Jeff Orlovsky. And in that, they had a bunch of tech executives and they asked them, would you allow your kids to go on Instagram? And their reactions just told the entire story. It was almost as though you'd ask them, would you be happy to give your children acid in their mug of milk at night? I mean, of course not. What a horrifying idea, you know. And I very much feel the same myself, that giving Instagram to children is really it's handing them a loaded gun because for their mental health, because it is designed to make them feel bad about themselves and to look for those tiny differences between themselves and these images that are being pumped into their minds. And without, you know, it's the speed with which, when we're doing a study at the moment, I mean, it is currently in field, as we say, in research. But that's looking at how quickly the algorithm then drives people through to really, really extreme content.
And just finally, this goes to the heart of all of this, doesn't it, Imran, that Ms. Howgen said that the problem is Facebook are reluctant to sacrifice, her words, even a slither of profit to make their platform safer.
I profoundly agree that that analysis is right. Where I differ from Ms. Howgen is, and she seems much more squeamish than I am on saying that when someone knows that they're creating harm, when they've covered up that they're creating harm, when they've lied to lawmakers and politicians and journalists about having created that harm, in my view, that's where you get to the point of criminal behavior. And I think that then that the bill's great weakness right now is that it's put off making the decision on whether or not to have criminal sanctions available for tech company executives who create harm and fail to do anything about it. And I think we're at the point where we need these people to feel the pressure. It's not just economic. It also has to be about their liberty itself.
Absolutely. That's Imran Ahmed, who's chief executive of the Centre for Countering Digital Hate. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with our other podcasts and video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. So the government has won a nationwide injunction against the infuriating Insulate Britain, which covers, they say, the entire strategic road network in England. They took action after the group once again brought traffic in parts of London to a standstill. It means protesters found blocking any of 4,300 miles of motorways and major A roads in England could face unlimited fines and up to 2 years in prison. Peter Blexley is a former Metropolitan Police officer and seasoned broadcaster and joins me now. Peter, at last, I say, these people drive me mad. I think they're doing their cause absolutely no good whatsoever, and they've been causing untold havoc and chaos to ordinary people's lives.
Indeed, not before time. There is so much anger and frustration about some of the, quite frankly, moronic actions of Insulate Britain that this injunction is well overdue. But begrudgingly, I feel that I have to give this group some small credit, because I think what they did was they exploited the fact that under the Highways Act of 1980, the maximum fine anybody could get is £50. So, of course, they knew they weren't going to be getting lengthy jail terms and the such like for this moronic behaviour. And it's taken a little bit of time for Grant Shapps, really, to get this injunction. And let's hope now we see some decisive and consistent policing.
The police are in a difficult position because they can't patrol every inch of motorway. They can't be certain where these wretched people are going to turn up next. And they move as quickly as they can. But sometimes they have looked a bit flat-footed.
Yes, they have. And there's a number of factors in play here. Firstly, around the M25 in the south of England particularly, that motorway is policed by lots of different police services. And we know there are inconsistencies from one police force to another. So often that depends upon the leadership that's at the helm. So we've seen some policing which, quite frankly, has been appalling, flaky and almost sympathetic towards these protesters, and other policing that's been swifter, more robust and has chimed more with the public. And certainly in this day and age, from what I'm seeing and hearing widely across social media and through other conversation platforms, it's that the public want to see proportionate yet decisive and swift action here.
Some people say to me, why don't we just leave them glued to the road, leave them glued to the pavement? One of these idiots glued his face to a road yesterday. But of course, if the police did that, the traffic disruption would go on for days.
And the economy would suffer. Having roads that move freely is vital to the economy. And never more have we needed an economy to recover than now. So that's why historically over the years, traffic departments of police services used to be very well funded because keeping the traffic moving was such a vital part of national infrastructure and economy. But another problem that has arisen, unfortunately, here, I think that the police have sometimes been reluctant to line up vans and just throw these people into the back of them. Because, of course, having had hundreds of police station closures in the last decade or more, there simply aren't the places where these people can be transported to swiftly because your local nick does not exist anymore.
Yeah, and the Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, is still closing them down. Can I ask you just finally, Peter, you can help me with this. So let's say, hypothetically, they go back onto the M4 or another motorway, so they've breached this all-encompassing injunction. How quickly would they be before a beak and either banged up in prison or subjected to a huge fine? Would it take days or weeks or months, in which case they could be back again and again?
Do you know what? You've got the wrong guest here, I've got to admit, Andrew, because the policing of injunctions is a fairly new kind of thing, and
it
didn't kind of hit the criminal stratosphere that I commonly operated within. But I hope that the policing, the removal, the getting them to police stations, the charging them under injunctions is swift, and therefore the process can be speeded up as much as it possibly can, because we all know justice delayed is justice denied.
Absolutely right. That's Peter Blexley, former Metropolitan Police Officer and broadcaster. So it's time now for our regular city update with Ruud Sunderland, who is, of course, business editor at the Daily Mail. So Mr. Midas Touch himself, Mr. Elon Musk, he's doing even better, isn't he, Ruth? Tesla stock soaring even higher.
Yes, that's right. So Tesla has actually surpassed a market value of $1 trillion. So it's only the fifth company ever to hit that hurdle and leap over it. The others, if anybody's interested in that, are Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, and Alphabet, which owns Google. They've all already hit that magic $1 trillion valuation on the US stock market. Now, this makes Mr. Elon Musk, he has just under a quarter of the business is still owned by him. So that's worth about $230 billion. He holds just less than 25%, around 23%. So, he's doing quite nicely, thank you, out of all of that.
No wonder he can afford to go into space on these very expensive trips.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think at that level, you know, if you're a Jeff Bezos or an Elon Musk, you can pretty much do what you want, can't you? Now, the question here, and you might be thinking, well, you know, why do I care about this? I mean, it's all very interesting, but, you know, it's a US company. If I drive a Tesla car, it doesn't particularly affect me. In actual fact, quite a lot of British small private investors do have a stake in Tesla. Can be indirectly, but Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, which is a very popular one, have quite a sizable holding in Tesla. Now, they did sell down a big chunk of their Tesla shares earlier this year because it had just got too dominant in the portfolio, but they've still got quite a bit. So people in this country are exposed to Tesla's valuation. And I think to just extend it out a little bit, Tesla's become a kind of mascot in a way for the whole tech sector. So, you know, people are wondering, is this kind of valuation actually realistic, or is it a bubble that might at some point burst?
And what of, Ruth, British cars, British electric cars? Are we buying Teslas here? Will we be buying many Teslas here, or are they predominantly being bought up by Americans?
Well, I mean, they're popular all over the world. I think that one of the big issues, in a sense, the big issue for in regard to this valuation, is it does depend on sales of Teslas roaring ahead in the future, no pun intended there. So the idea is that, you know, electric cars are going to go mainstream. That's certainly, you know, in an age of environmental consciousness, where it looks to be heading. We have, the car buying public and the auto industry have got this wrong before. I mean, you remember, you know, at one point it was thought that we were all going to go diesel, and we know where that all ended up.
Yes, we do.
I think one of the questions is that when the mainstream car makers, which are still selling a lot more than Tesla, when they get their act together, when and if they get their act together and produce electric vehicles of their own, can Tesla actually sustain this $1 trillion valuation, or will some of those other car makers overtake them? Sorry, I don't mean to come out with these driving puns.
They're rather good, I think, George. They're rather good. Yeah. What's your hunch?
I am a little bit of a Tesla skeptic. Mm. So I think that the cars themselves are very popular, clearly. But I just wonder whether this is, I think at this kind of valuation, those shares are very, very vulnerable. I also have a bit of an issue around the personality of Elon Musk himself. He loves an indiscreet tweet. He's clearly a little bit of an eccentric. I mean, he can afford to be, that's true. But I tend to prefer a more boring founder and CEO. I'm not so keen on the interesting ones. I think it may come off brilliantly well, but at the same time, it can be quite high risk to follow these guys.
Just think, Philip Green. It all looked so marvellous at one point, didn't it?
Absolutely. If something looks too good to be true, I think you do need to be quite careful.
Very good advice as ever from our very own business editor at the Daily Mail, Ruth Sunderland. Brits from across the UK and Europe are joining forces to highlight the health issues they say flat-faced animals like bulldogs are facing. The campaign Please Don't Buy Flat-Faced Animals wants the public to understand not only the health problems for the animals concerned, but also how devastating it is for their owners and the vets who treat them. I'm joined now by the founder of the campaign, who is the celebrity vet, Emma Milne, and she joins me now. Emma, we all know these pugs and other flat-faced breeds. They look rather charming, although some people might think they're rather ugly. They've proved to be very popular, haven't they? That's been part of the problem.
Yeah, I think particularly with the dogs, their popularity in the last decade or so, it has absolutely exploded. I think back in about 2007, the Kennel Club used to register about 1,000 French bulldogs a year, and now that's up to around 33,000 to 35,000 a year. And when you add in, obviously, the numbers that aren't registered by the Kennel Club and the numbers around the world, it's absolutely a massive number that are suffering with these health issues. One of the things we wanted to highlight as well with the video that we've launched today is that it's not just the dogs. These issues are affecting cats and rabbits, and even now horses are being bred with these slightly deformed faces.
And what's the problem with the pugs and the flat-faced breeds? They're prone to they have respiratory issues, which could require surgery. They can also have eye problems and also difficulties in eating.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the thing is, in the last few years, lots of vets and organisations have highlighted the breathing problems, because obviously that is the most devastating thing for these animals. We know that probably amongst French and English bulldogs and pugs, the studies show that probably at least around 50% of them are clinically affected by breathing difficulties. But the problem is, it's not just that, because they've got these very short faces. They tend to have very large tongues that don't fit properly in their mouth. Their teeth don't line up because their jaws are deformed. Some of the other breeds that are affected, like Cavalier King Charles now, the shape of their head even doesn't allow their brain for some of them to fit in their skull anymore. So they have these herniations out of the back of the skull. So, and I think for me, fundamentally, one of the things that I've said many times is that we also know that these, particularly the dog breeds, have massive problems reproducing. There's loads of fertility clinics now. And I think really you have to ask serious ethical questions if these breeds are clinging to life through veterinary intervention, which I believe they are largely.
And what's the advice from your campaign? I mean, you're encouraging people don't buy them, but I mean, a lot of people are continuing to breed them. That's the big problem too, Emma, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think the thing is, There are lots of countries across Europe and the UK included that have laws that should actually prevent the breeding of animals that are likely to suffer, which we know these are, but sadly they're not enforced. So our aim really with this campaign is to try and, to, because the only way we can change it if the law doesn't work is to reduce the demand for them. You know, it almost needs to be stigmatized like drink driving or smoking or those kind of things, that it's not cute to have these animals. I think one thing it's very important to highlight as well is that we're not saying that we need to, that we should be getting rid of all the animals that are already born. We're just saying we shouldn't be breeding any more of them. You know, it's time to, you know, it's time to take stock of what we've done to these animals and say no more.
Breeders, of course, are making big bucks out of it, and that's a big problem. How do you stop them doing that?
Well, I think this is a massive, it's a massive problem. And I know that the Mail have highlighted this week the problem with these new colours and so on that are becoming extremely popular, particularly among bulldogs and Dachshunds and so on. I think the difficulty is that there's so many problems with it. We know they've got devastating health issues. Now people are adding in these even more genetic difficulties. A lot of these colour combinations that create the lilac and blue colours that people are loving and charging ridiculous amounts of money for. If they're, worst case scenario, they can lead to puppies dying soon after birth or being deaf or blind or both. So the fact that you've taken a horribly diseased breed and then added in extra genetic difficulties, and then you're asking people to pay huge sums of money for it, of course you will open the floodgates to unscrupulous breeders. And I think that's why either the government or the Kennel Club or us as vets need to actually really crack down on it.
What are people paying for these pups?
It varies around the world, but commonly between £5,000 and £10,000.
Oh my God! What?
So if you, and I think some of the very rare ones, if they're being sold for stud animals, are going for tens of thousands of pounds,
no,
or dollars, depending on where you are. But the thing is, I guess it's a bit like sports cars, where people assume that if they've got a high price tag, they must
yes.
be somehow
yes.
very valuable. And actually, as vets, we're kind of hanging our heads in dread, which is, you know, one of the things the video says is that we know we're going to see these problems. And actually, just from the veterinary profession point of view, I've been contacted by lots of vets around the world who are just beside themselves at what they're seeing. Every day, our clinics are full of these animals who are suffering. And because the high price tags make people think they're amazing.
Of course, but then the owners are going to have all the emotional trauma when the dog gets really sick and potentially dies very young or prematurely.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something that for, I mean, as vets, one of the things that I wrote the words for the video that we've launched. And
yeah,
one of the things I wanted to say to people is, as a vet, it's really difficult when you've treated an animal for a long time. We understand that pain and that grief. And often it's very upsetting for us because we know those animals. We've been, you know, we've followed those owners and animals through their lives. But when you have to euthanize a young animal or you can't help a young animal, it's even worse. You know, we accept that it's part of life to lose our, you know, for people to lose pets and for us as vets to see that happen. But when it's happening at the age of 2 or 4 or 6, you know, and we know that brachycephalic animals live shorter lives than their other counterparts. And actually, for the owners, a lot of the time, because they are tending some people to buy them on impulse, and because some breeders are not upfront about the issues that they have, the owners are just, you know, it's a double, triple whammy. They lose their dog, they've spent a fortune on it, then they spend a fortune on trying to fix the dog or cat or rabbit. And finally, they end up with nothing. It's devastating. I think we just don't know what to do about it. So we just need to try and get the message out there. That's, you know, as what we're trying to achieve.
Well, I think it's a really important campaign, Emma. And if people are listening, go down your animal sanctuary and get a nice old Labrador. Can't go wrong with that, can you? Or a nice old Heinz 57 cat.
Healthy mongrel.
Can't go wrong. Absolutely. Can't go wrong with it. That's the veterinarian, Emma Mill, celebrity vet. You'll know her well, who's leading this campaign. Please don't buy flat-faced animals. It's a really important campaign, so heed it. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m, you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.